the first refugee ever elected to Congress.
The machinery of democracy should work for everyone everywhere, not just in certain places and not just on a certain day.
Power sees nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. We still have to be willing to show up every single day and demand our seat at the table.
So f***ing proud of you guys.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 248. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is Andrew Torres, and welcome to The Cert Show with Andrew Thomas. How's it going, Andrew?
It is going fantastic. How's it going with you?
Good. I'm excited for Cert, you know?
I think we all are, right? I want to know. You will know. Our listeners will have determined. I kind of want to see if there's a public domain picture of a roll of certs, the, you know, breath mint from the 1980s that I grew up with, but...
We'll find out. OA get really pumped for CERT, you know, we're just so pumped. We're going to talk about, you teased it last week, the CERT before judgment, a little interesting nuance there, so we're going to learn more about that, and then we're going to talk about another case that, I don't know if it's spoilers, but was CERT denied or granted on another case, and then we're going to talk about an overtime case involving Hilton. So we'll see. That's what we've got. Hopefully a little less depressing than the last episode, but I don't know. Yeah, you never know. And what do you think? Oh, announcements. Of course, it's close to the end of the month here, so you should have a lot off of movies delivered to your door, provided you take your cell phone and put it at your door and refresh the feed. So, but that's that's understood. But delivered to your door, by already maybe, or if not now, then within a day or two at most, depending on how long the edit takes. But a lot off of movies coming at you, and then we want to tell you about the Q&A, the patron only question part of the Q&A, but everybody can watch on YouTube, and that is happening today. If you're listening to this as it came out today, the 29th, Tuesday, at 4 Pacific, 7 Eastern. Come, hop on, listen in, get in on that chat. Of course, the question thread is already up on patreon.com/law for patrons only. So go ask questions, vote on questions, tell us which ones you want to have answered. And exciting stuff. Any other announcements?
Yeah, I plugged here that I went on to our buddy Bryce Blankenegel's show, Naked Mormonism, and after we did that, which was this really interesting 1843 case involving Joseph Smith being extradited back to Missouri, and there were all these like great law geekery questions, and plus I got to read an early 19th century case, and so I was just in law geek heaven. And then Bryce and I stuck around for like an extra hour and recorded some audio for our respective patrons, so we're going to release that to with Bryce's permission to our patron feed. It wanders pretty quickly, so we move from 1843 to the parallels to today, and the really cool thing, and you could forward to the end if you really want just the answer, but I give you the senator, the one person in the United States Senate right now who is the apex, the Sherpa, the gatekeeper to the apex of Yodel Mountain. So lots of fun stuff in that.
What are you doing that on another person's show for?
What's going to be on our show?
Okay. All right. Well,
no,
you definitely want to catch that,
no
everybody.
Disloyalty intended.
All right. Well, with that said, let's get to the search show with Thomas and Andrew. It's our new late night talk show that we're doing. The search show. Here we go.
First is a candy mint. First is a breath mint.
Stop. You're both right. New search is two mint in one. Stop that present second. Tastiest mint of all.
So, search before judgment. What happened there? You teased it. It sounds kind of self-explanatory, but I'm guessing there's a lot of little nuances there to go through.
Yeah, so a couple of things here, and this will overlap with a bunch of our pending stories. I mentioned last week that during the week of January 16th, the Supreme Court, what they did was they relisted six separate petitions for writ of certiorari. That's not all that uncommon. What it means to relist is kind of exactly what it sounds like. It means that the petitions were circulated around the conference table, and instead of having a thumbs up, thumbs down, yes or no vote, the Supreme Court said, you know what, like, let's talk about that some other time, right? Let's talk about it next week when we get together. And what was interesting from a law geekery perspective was that all six of those relists were cases that were pending before the Supreme Court on a petition for writ of certiorari before judgment. Right. So three of them were in the three cases that we talked about on Friday that involved the trans ban. The other three cases are all DACA cases, right? They involve lawsuits that are at various stages involving the challenge to the Trump administration's decision to end DACA by executive order, and challenging those under the Administrative Procedure Act as not having a sufficient and rational basis. And it got me thinking that this looks like this is an impending strategy for this administration to continue to take advantage of a Supreme Court that it has now completely transformed into an activist right-wing machine. What petitions for cert before judgment do is allow, if the Supreme Court takes it up, allow the Supreme Court to bypass the requisite circuit courts of appeal. And you've heard the administration bemoan the liberal Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit is the most liberal of the circuits, but you know, there's nothing illegitimate about it. You're seeing this administration in an unprecedented way really try and cut out the appellate branch of the judiciary. And so I thought I'd take a quick look into these petitions and see how regular they're, right? I mean, you know, because it feels bad, right? It feels like a way of weaponizing an activist Supreme Court. But, well, you know.
Yeah, ahead. I want to go devil's advocate here, because we talk about, like, what reasons that the Supreme Court will grant cert. And one of them, I think, is when there's a disagreement between the circuit courts, right? And it's a question that people care about. Sometimes you can just fast track it straight to the Supreme Court, if I have that right. So it doesn't sound that terribly unreasonable that this would be something where it should just go straight to the Supreme Court and skip the part where, you know, for months we go through this process of, you know, the Ninth Circuit ruling one way and the whatever circuit ruling another. We know it's going to happen anyway, so why not just cut to the chase? Is that not reasonable?
So as it turns out, that may be intuitive, but as it turns out, these kinds of petitions are very, 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 very rare. They are subject to Supreme Court Rule 11, right? And they're authorized by statute, right? So the provision is 28 U.S.C. 2101E, which allows the Supreme Court to accept a petition for certiorari at any time before judgment. But the Supreme Court's rules of procedure specify that such petitions should be granted, quote, only upon a showing that the case is of such imperative public importance as to justify deviation from the normal appellate practice and to require immediate determination in this court, end of quote. And that comes from a couple of different things, right? So it's tempting to look at the immediate situation in which you're like, okay, well, we have a conservative Supreme Court. This case is a conservative case. So whatever happens, it's going to get up there and they're going to rubber stamp the conservative outcome. That's not the way the Supreme Court is supposed to work. And historically, when the court has been left or right, it's not been the way the Supreme Court has branded itself as working. And so, you know, justices frequently in the past have prided themselves on, you know, sort of being unpredictable. There's also a notion that you know, goes along with the whole concept of certiorari in the first place, that you don't resolve an issue with the Supreme Court unless you have to. Right, unless it is absolutely imperative that go before the Supreme Court, and that's why this is a question I answered, I think, a long time ago on the show and recently on Twitter. It's why when the Supreme Court lets an opinion stand, say they let an opinion from the Ninth Circuit stand, that carries no special weight. Right. That does not mean that the Supreme Court agrees with the disposition of that opinion, even that they agree with the outcome. It certainly doesn't mean that they agree with the reasoning. That's designed to allow the Supreme Court really to have the maximum amount of flexibility in picking its docket and to say, hey, look, we're really only going to take the cases that require adjudication by the Supreme Court of the land. And so that practice is by far not a normal practice. And so I took a look at the cases in which the Supreme Court in the past 100 years has granted writs of certiorari before judgment. And I found really that they fall into two categories. Overwhelming majority. Almost all of them are cases in which you have two or more cases, and they are at different stages of the appellate process. Let me give you a really clear example of that. In the early 2000s, there was a case, U.S. versus Booker, that came out of Wisconsin that challenged the federal sentencing guidelines. Right, and the federal sentencing guidelines were mandatory before 2005. And Booker made the argument, which was accepted by the Seventh Circuit, that the guidelines could not be mandatory. You couldn't force a judge to give only the sentence that's in the sentencing guidelines because that would contradict your Sixth Amendment right to a trial by jury. So the Seventh Circuit issued that opinion at the same time that another case was pending at the district court level. That case was called U.S. versus Fanfan. It had similar facts. It was coming out of Maine, right? And so in that case, the government petitioned, they appealed Booker to the Supreme Court. That was clearly going to the Supreme Court. And they petitioned for a writ of certiorari before judgment in the Fanfan case and was like, look, you're going to decide whether the guidelines are advisory or binding. It makes sense to group these two cases together. Right. We don't need to hear from the First Circuit and see if there's a split. You're going to take up the Seventh Circuit case anyway. Take these cases both up together. And almost all of the petitions that are granted for that procedural reason. Right. They're not granted based on the substance. They're granted based on how those cases get there. The very few cases to sort of bypass the ordinary appellate review process, almost all of them, literally all but like one or two that I could find, and we're only talking about a small handful to begin with, are cases involving the extent of executive power, in particular, the president's power during wartime, right? So 1942 case, ex parte querin regarding the president's power to try German saboteurs during World War II in military tribunals versus in civilian tribunals. The United Mine Workers case regarding the seizure attempted seizure of coal mines at the end of World War II. Famously, the Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company case. It was 1952. That was Harry Truman's attempt to seize control of the steel companies and nationalize them during the Korean War. And then U.S. v. Nixon, right, regarding turning over the Nixon tape. In 1974. Right. Those are the cases that came up on this procedure. It is not common to see just cases come up for political reasons. So let me speak to your suggestion. In 2011, the state of Virginia applied, petitioned to bypass the Fourth Circuit for a writ of certiorari before judgment in one of the Obamacare cases, right? And the Supreme Court was like, no, look, we're just going to let this run its course. Right. And so you might have said, oh, look, this is going to be politically charged and it's going to be politically charged once it gets up here. But the Supreme Court said that doesn't rise to the level of our Rule 11. Right. It is not of such imperative public importance that we've got to take it right now. Trump is trying to change that. And so I want you to keep an eye on the number of cert petitions before judgment. And I want you to keep an eye, and we're going to do this on the show. I want you to keep an eye on whether this Supreme Court grants those petitions, right? I mean, one of the things we've talked about for new, quote, swing justice John Roberts, right? And he is, right? I mean, his hinge, the fulcrum is way far to the right, but Roberts is the swing guy now, is his sort of quest for institutional legitimacy and not wanting to be perceived as the bus driver for, a gang of crazy activists. If that remains the case, right? If we make it through the next 2 years of the Trump presidency without another Supreme Court nominee, which is by far from a sure thing. But if we do, I think this is one of those questions that is interesting, right? Is John Roberts going to have a skepticism towards granting these sorts of petitions? Or is he going to go along with the hardcore activist gang of four that does not care? And we're going to talk about that hardcore activist gang of four throughout this episode. But whenever there's an opportunity to maybe shine the spotlight on John Roberts there, I would like to do that. Those are your cert petitions before judgment, and they directly relate to the next topic on our list.
All right. So very seems pretty rare. So makes sense that they denied it. It doesn't really, you don't think that it says anything about what the Supreme Court is leaning toward in terms of a ruling? Is it, do you think it's more just a procedural, like this is how it's done versus, telegraphing anything about where they would come down on the actual case?
Yeah, I think that's right. And again, remember, if you have these cases, right? Like if the case comes down the way in which the majority would want the case to come down, right? That will moot the need for the Supreme Court to take it up, right? So even on kind of the most practical basis, right? It is typical for the Supreme Court to just say, yeah, no, this is not immediately exigent circumstances such that we've got to take the case right now. So I don't read anything into the merits. I would read something into if the Supreme Court starts granting a lot of these cert petitions before judgment. That would signify that, the governors are off and, we are on a fast track to crazy town. We're on a slow track. Look, like that's going to happen. It's bad.
Or
the Supreme Court is not going to be
crazy town. No, we're not. In this respect, I guess we're not there yet.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk about then our next segment. Some more cert on the cert show. Next cert on the cert show. Go ahead.
Stops bad breath in seconds. Tastiest mint of all. Yes, only new certs gives you two mints in one.
Yeah. So, so what does this have to do with the census? We talked about that in episode 232, and I mentioned at the time that this was a strange grant of cert, right? Because what you had was a district court that had ordered discovery of Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross. It had ordered him to sit for a deposition. And the government petitioned that collaterally all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court granted certiorari to resolve that issue while the trial was still pending. And I told you at the time that the reason that was really, really strange is because the trial could go to verdict and you could get a result without having to depose this guy. And in fact, that is what we now have. So on the one hand, we have good news on the census. Good news is sometimes rare on the show. But the court issued a post-trial decision that the efforts by the Trump administration to politicize the census were, quote, a smorgasbord of classic clear-cut APA, that's the Administrative Procedure Act, violations.
Huh.
And enjoined the Trump administration from changing the census. Really, really good result. They did so without taking the deposition of Commerce Secretary Ross. And in fact, the court's opinion says this opinion is based on comprehensive findings of fact and conclusions of law, quote, based exclusively on the materials in the official administrative record, end of quote. And that means without having to take discovery. And then it says, the discovery that was taken here confirmed our findings that this was a transparently naked political attempt to weaponize the census. But we didn't need that. We could decide this just on the administrative record. And so as a result, the petitioners have now gone to the Supreme Court with a motion. And that motion is to dismiss the writ of certiorari as improvidently granted. And the argument there is, look, this court does not have jurisdiction anymore. There's no live case or controversy because we don't need to depose this guy anymore. We're not going to. Case is over. And there's no reason for you. This case, by the way, is scheduled for oral argument in a month, right? Wow. Scheduled for oral argument on February 20th. The parties have already filed their initial set of briefs. After the petitioners filed this motion on January 17th. On January 18th, the Supreme Court took it off the calendar. They did not grant the motion yet, but they canceled the oral argument that was scheduled for February and suspended the briefing schedule, quote, pending further order of this court, end of quote. What's interesting is the government's response to the motion to dismiss the writ as being improvidently granted, and I'm going to read it to you. This court should defer consideration of respondents' motion to dismiss the writ of certiorari as improvidently granted. The government intends to file forthwith a petition for writ of certiorari before judgment, with a proposal for expedited briefing to allow for oral argument and decision this term. The court should therefore defer ruling on respondent's motion until it rules on the forthcoming petition. If the court denies that petition, however, meaning for a writ of certiorari of before judgment, it should grant respondent's motion and dismiss this case. So what the government is saying is, yeah, we agree this court lacks jurisdiction, but we want you to grant the writ you should have granted in the first place, in our view, which is before judgment, before the appellate court can review. We want the Supreme Court to take up this issue and rule on it. And the reason to do that is because the changes, the census must be finalized by June of 2019. And so what the government fears, quite obviously, is an appellate court ruling up, sustaining the lower court's ruling and time running out before this activist Supreme Court can jump in and go, no, it's totally fine for you to use the 2020 census in a nakedly partisan way. So we'll know next week, probably next week, what the Supreme Court intends to do on the census question. I suspect that they are going to grant the writ. I suspect that they are going to take this up and bypass the intermediate appellate court. It will be noteworthy if they do not. So that's what my eyes will be on. And that's why I wanted to flag it now.
I'm having a hard time following. This is really complicated. So is this a bad, good, bad sign? I don't know. I'm so twisted in the granting of the denying of the, you know, like, what are you more worried now than not before, or less worried?
I'm the same level of worried right now. Right. So here's the thing, right? The decision, right, in the Southern District of New York at the trial court level is an unambiguously good decision.
Okay.
That decision is going to be appealed to the Second Circuit by the government. The government at the same time is going to file a petition with the Supreme Court to grant a writ of certiorari to bypass the Second Circuit and rule on the merits now. And so
the same thing you're talking about in the first case.
Yep.
Right.
Yep. And so the interesting thing to track is whether the Supreme Court grants or denies the government's request. And we should know that really, really soon.
Is there any reason why this would be different? Is it just the time constraints in terms of what the court might be thinking?
Right, because the reason to bypass is because the census question must be resolved.
Gotcha.
Got to be finalized by June of 2019. And so if it goes through the ordinary appellate process, then the Second Circuit, all they have to do is, I mean, it would strike me as almost impossible for the Second Circuit to rule much before June of 2019. But certainly there would not be time for the Second Circuit to rule and then you to file a petition to the Supreme Court and have the Supreme Court hear it and rule. Like, that's just not going to happen before the printing of the census. And so that's going to be the issue. And it will be very, very interesting if it will not surprise me if the Supreme Court grants a bypass here, even though, you know, as we talked about in the opening segment, this is not a common thing. But it would not surprise me if they do. It would surprise me if they don't. And that would be a very good sign. That would be a point in favor of the John Roberts institutionalist does not want to be viewed as a Republican Party hack thesis. And you know, we're grasping at silver linings and and look, like, that thesis has some plausibility. You need to marshal evidence in favor of it. Here is a decision point which would count as evidence. And we're going to keep our eye out.
All right. Well, stay tuned, folks. We'll have to check back once we have more information on that. And there's more cert coming your way on the Cert Show. But first, these messages.
Cool, clean, and fresh tasting. Inside a sparkling drop of Redsyn. For fresh, clean breath that really lasts. Cert's Cool Mint Drops, so you can keep your cool longer. Available in new freshmen, too.
All right, more cert. can't get enough cert. Talk about this next case here.
Okay, so 2 days ago, the Supreme Court did a thing that I've never, ever, ever seen it do before.
Wow.
And so that's interesting to me. And I thought maybe it would be interesting to you. Here's what they did. There was a dissent from a denial of certiorari in the case Kennedy versus Bremerton School District. I'm going to talk about the facts of that case super briefly because they're horrifying, that the Supreme Court had four justices that wanted to grant cert in this case. But you will also notice I said the magic number, right? There were four justices who dissented from the denial of cert, but it only takes four justices to grant cert. So what the hell is going on?
Whoa, weird.
What happens
now,
is...
Now, just to clarify, granting or denying cert with a dissent is not itself the thing they've never done before, right? It's just the fact that there's four, so they could have granted cert?
Correct. Correct. Weird. In fact, you will see orders, right, where when there is a denial of cert, we talked about, right, that...
Yeah, I seem to remember that something recent involved
Clarence Thomas wrote a blistering dissent from the Supreme Court's refusal to grant cert in the Planned Parenthood funding cases.
Right.
Which we talked about on the show, right? So, yeah, you can write a dissent and say, I can't believe we didn't grant cert in this case. This is called, and again, I have literally never seen this, and I've been practicing law for 22 years and went to law school before that. It says, statement of Justice Alito, with whom Justice Thomas, Justice Gorsuch, and Justice Kavanaugh join. So, right, you know, the crazy four, respecting the denial of certiorari. So here's what they say. I concur in the denial of the petition for a writ of certiorari because denial of certiorari does not signify that the court necessarily agrees with the decision, much less the opinion below. Sidebar, we're going to link this in the show notes, but this is a great case to link when you have an argument with your Uncle Frank or with someone else on social media and they say, oh, well, you know, the Supreme Court let this stand, so therefore they agree with it. This is a clear statement that that doesn't mean anything. But let's go on. In this case, important unresolved factual questions would make it very difficult, if not impossible at this stage, to decide the free speech question. So it would be bad to grant the petition. And I'm going to talk about the merits of the case. But then they go on to kind of opine about two aspects of law that are super troubling and exactly what I have predicted. So let me describe the case. This case involves Bremerton High School, which is just outside of Seattle, Washington, and football coach Joseph Kennedy. And you want to take a wild guess as to what Joseph Kennedy does?
Has his team pray on the field or something?
Yep. For years, he would take his team out onto the field and lead them in prayer and deliver religious sermons to them. Our wow. friends, the FFRF, wrote a letter, said you can't do that. When that letter got to the school district superintendent, Kennedy was directed to stop in order to respect the religious freedom of all the students, as well as, quote, to avoid liability for violating their constitutional rights, end of quote. Although initially complying, Kennedy then continued to what the petition describes as voluntarily pray on his own, which meant as soon as the games ended, he would go over and kneel at the 50-yard line in the middle of the school's field in school attire, surrounded by students, and the school tried on multiple occasions to accommodate him, to say, hey, look, like, dude, prayer is fine. Prayer immediately after the game while people are still in the stands, while you're in your uniform, while the kids are around. Like, come on, man. But Kennedy is one of these activists for whom that was not good enough. And he sued and lost and appealed and lost. And then petition to the Supreme Court. And so the Supreme Court refused to grant cert in his case, which of course they should, because this is an obvious, you know, clear and open and shut case. This dissent, and again, it's the weirdest thing I've ever seen, has three parts. So part number one is on the facts and says, well, you know, like, and I'm not going to go through the facts. It's troubling that they would have any sort of view of the facts here. Part two says...
Sorry, what do you mean by that? I'm not sure what you're saying there. Troubling that they would have a view of the facts? Are you saying they're trying to say there might be an interpretation of the facts that could make this okay, and you're saying that's...
That's insane? Exactly what I'm saying, right? Okay. So, for example,
what would that be?
Yeah, well, here's what they say, right? When the case was before the district court, the court should have made a specific finding as to what petitioner was likely able to show regarding the reason or reasons for his loss of employment. If the likely reason was simply his neglect of his duties, if, for example, he was supposed to have been actively supervising the players after they had left the field, but instead left them unsupervised while he prayed on his own, then his free speech claim would likely fail. On the other hand, his free speech claim would have far greater weight if petitioner was likely to be able to establish either that he was not really on duty at the time in question, or that he was on duty only in the sense that his workday had not ended and his prayer took place at a time in which it would have been permissible for him to engage briefly in private conduct, say, calling home or making a reservation for dinner at a local restaurant. So the reason I say that that's troubling is, you know, we've had Andrew Seidel on the show. To characterize kneeling at the 50-yard line as the equivalent of calling Quiznos, I don't. So that's what I meant by my sidebar of that's kind
calling
of
troubling. Calling Quiznos to make that Quiznos reservation for dinner.
Yeah.
Hi,
yeah.
Quiznos, you have a table for two?
Exactly. You want to
do something special with my wife? Your finest table, Quiznos. Okay, we'll see you then.
Yeah. Section two, I only want to pause briefly on it because it criticizes the Ninth Circuit's application of a case called Garcetti versus Sabalos. And it says you're applying this, quote, in a highly tendentious way, end of quote. And then they say under this interpretation, a teacher can be ordered not to engage in any demonstrative conduct of a religious nature, such as folding their hands or bowing their heads in prayer. And a school could regulate what teachers do during a period when they're not teaching by preventing them from reading things that might be spotted by students or saying things that might be overheard. Okay, that's a little bit troubling. That's not why I brought this to your attention. I brought this to your attention because of Section 3, which shocked me even for this Supreme Court. I'm going to read it to you. Petition is based on the Free Speech Clause of the First Amendment. Petitioner still has live claims under the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment. Petitioner's decision to rely primarily on his free speech claims, as opposed to these alternative claims, may be due to certain decisions of this court. In Employment Division versus Smith, this court drastically cut back on the protection provided by the Free Exercise Clause. And in Transworld Airlines versus Hardison, a 1977 case that we haven't discussed previously, but was relied upon by Scalia in the Smith case. We know Smith is the peyote case. We've talked about it a great length.
Yeah, we've talked about that one.
The court opined that Title VII's prohibition of discrimination on the basis of religion does not require an employer to make any accommodation that imposes more than a de minimis burden. In this case, however, we have not been asked to revisit those decisions. And that's the end. That is an open invitation from the nutjob contingent of this court to say, give us a case to overrule Employment Division versus Smith. It should be troubling because, again, this court does not care about precedent. It does not care that it is beloved Scalia precedent. This case is headed
towards...
Yeah,
that's them saying Scalia wasn't Scalia enough. We need
yes.
to...
Scalia mistakenly thought that his decision would only apply to weird brown people religions and
right.
not to Christianity. And it's time to overrule Employment Division versus Smith. This would be terrible in every conceivable way. It would effectively, right, overruling Employment Division versus Smith, that's what RFRA does by statute, right? So it would take the Supreme Court and every lower court's body of RFRA jurisprudence and incorporate them out to the states as part of the First Amendment's protection of free exercise. It would be monumental. Game-changing. And this Supreme Court has at least four members that have openly espoused, we've talked about it from Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, have openly espoused the accommodationist theory, which essentially says that the Supreme Court's, and again, we're talking about a free exercise claim here, the accommodationist theory concerns the Establishment Clause, but the issues often overlap, have espoused an accommodationist theory of the First Amendment. And that accommodationist theory is the idea that the Establishment Clause prohibits only the favoring of one religion over another, say Catholicism over Protestantism, but not, and again, William Rehnquist has written this word for word, but not favoring religion generally over irreligion. That is where we are headed. We are headed to a Supreme Court that is going to say there is nothing wrong with the government preferring religious belief and expressions to non-religious belief and expressions. It's coming.
Wow. Oh, but okay, but I still am not quite understanding the four-person dissent on cert. How does that work exactly?
So they can't call it a dissent for precisely that reason, right? Like, that's why they called it a statement. This is their way of saying, get us a better case on better facts of saying, okay. Boy, even these loons, right? Okay, look, we get it. No matter how much we rewrite, saying a prayer at the 50-yard line with full stands at a high school football game with in your uniform with your kids around you, like, no matter how much we try and rewrite that as making the call to Quiznos, come on. Like, we could lose Roberts. So we don't want to lose Roberts on this one, but give us a better case and maybe we won't.
This is like a want ad. Like, they're putting out, this is those four loons. Like, Craigslist ad. Can you please bring us a better case so that we can overturn decades of precedent that already was not exactly was already pretty right-wing to begin with, and we want to make it more right-wing. So they want people to respond to their Craigslist ad. Got it. Okay. So it's
exactly
not really a
right.
dissent. Yeah. Oh, that is bizarre. Well, on that disturbing note, I'm deeply worried now, but that's okay. We can move on to another case. Is this cert related, or are we all out of certs?
I came
here to chew gum and grant cert, and I'm all out of...
I think there was briefly a cert gum, but we're out of certs, but not out of religious cases and not out of outrage. So
we're all out of certs to give. Hey, listeners, so many people have their own businesses or starting their own podcasts, YouTube channels, whatever it might be. And one of the best ways to make connections and to look professional and to really feel professional as well is by having a nice business card. You never know when opportunity is going to strike, and having a business card that shows how professional you are in your pocket, ready to hand out, is the first step to making something happen. Your next big opportunity is coming right now, and all it takes to feel like you're ready to own the now is $10. That's a low price to have the confidence that you're always ready to make an impression or get seen in a new way. A custom card with the colors, fonts, and designs and images you choose means you can look and feel like a big deal, whether you're a startup or a business with a century of history. And it doesn't have to be hard. With Vistaprint, you can create a truly professional, unique card in minutes. You upload your design or start with one of their professionally designed options. Vistaprint offers simple tools and a wide range of templates to choose from. You pick the paper stock, the style, and the quantity that's right for you. Choose your delivery speed, order, and receive your cards in as few as 3 days. And your satisfaction is 100% guaranteed, or they will make it right either by reprinting your order or offering a refund. Vistaprint wants you to be able to own the now in any situation, which is why our listeners will get 500 high-quality custom business cards starting at $9.99. Use code OA at Vistaprint.com. That's code OA at Vistaprint.com. One last time, OA at Vistaprint.com. Okay, what's our next case, if not cert-related? Let's talk Hilton and overtime and be worried about... bringing employment law back to the 19th century. Can't wait. Here we go.
So there was a decision that was reported on by CBS initially with the headline, Hilton Dishwasher Awarded $21.5 million for Having to Work on Sundays. And then picked up by usually our friends over at the Friendly Atheist blog, Christian fired for skipping work to go to church, awarded $21 million by jury. That is grotesquely irresponsible reporting by CBS and sensationalizing over at Friendly Atheist. The case doesn't say that, and I absolutely wanted to work through it. I've talked about this a little bit on social media, but there is a much greater principle at stake here, and that is the efforts to demonize plaintiffs who bring lawsuits against big companies, to portray them as getting these kind of ridiculous windfalls, and we need to call out quote unquote our side when they do it.
Well, I was going to ask you, did you get any response? Because I can talk to them. Friendly Atheist. I guess I'll. Did you get any engagement on that yet, or
not yet?
Okay.
So,
well,
yeah,
shoot.
I'd
I
love
may be
for
writing
to,
an awkward email. Okay, here we go
to talk. So I'm going to upload the complaint and the jury verdict. But here's what this case was about, okay? The plaintiff was Marie Jean-Pierre, and she worked for a hotel in Florida that was owned by Hilton, by Defendant Park Hotels and Resort, which was in turn owned by the Hilton Corporation. And she was a member of the Soldiers of Christ Church in Miami, Florida, and the Bethel Church in Miami, Florida. I don't know how you're simultaneously a member of both churches, but whatever. It's not my thing. From the moment,
isn't that like inviting two boys to the prom and then you gotta do the feels like it'd be awkward.
Yeah, this was a Saved by the Bell episode. Look, she was hired knowing that their religious beliefs were that she didn't work on Sundays.
Right.
And so she was hired in 2006, and for 3 years, they didn't schedule her to work on a Sunday. Then March 2009, she was scheduled to work on a Sunday, and she said, okay, well, then I'm going to quit. And then in an effort to prevent her from quitting, the hotel said, no, look, you're a valuable employee. Stick around. We won't schedule you for Sundays. And so she said, okay, well, then I'll stick around. And she worked Monday through Thursday. So four 10-hour days until late of 2015. So this is 9 years, including an incident in which she threatened to quit, in which the hotel said, yeah, okay, fine. Again, different accommodations laws apply to different employers, right? This does not mean, you know, that we have to have, you know, Republicans come on our podcast or any dumb thing like that, right? These are the terms of her employment. In late 2015, she got a new supervisor, and the supervisor changed her work schedule so that she had to work on Sundays. She and her pastor wrote letters to her new supervisor saying, we had an accommodation. She believes that it's wrong to work on Sundays. It violates her religious beliefs. And her supervisor continued to schedule her to work on a Sunday. What Miss Jean-Pierre did was, I guess, kind of like, you know, wait staff at a restaurant, she began negotiating shift swaps with other employees. Yeah. Right.
And I remember those days in my service career.
Yeah. So she swapped out her Sunday shifts for other employees, traded off, worked their shifts. That continued for a couple of weeks. And then on March 27th of 2016, her supervisor saw somebody else working Marie Jean-Pierre's shift and said, and sent that person home and said, no, I want Marie here. And then 4 days later, she was fired.
Wow.
And in the interim, right, she wrote to her supervisor's supervisor, right, and said, look, like, I've been trying to accommodate. I tried to work within this. And, you know, and this guy keeps scheduling me. And now, you know, when I tried to accommodate you, he fired me. You know, he won't even let me swap shifts anymore.
Yeah.
The lawsuit brought three causes of action, right? Brought a claim for religious discrimination. She lost on that. Brought a claim for failure to accommodate. She lost on that. Right. So the jury very reasonably said, no, look, like, and I'm going to upload the jury verdict, said, look, like, by and large, this firm did, you know, this the Hilton did the right thing for most of the time that she worked there. But her third claim was a claim for retaliatory discharge. And they said, yeah, it looks to us pretty clearly like she was fired for trying to work this out.
Yeah.
And to make a claim for retaliatory discharge under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, you have to show three things. You have to show, number one, that you engaged in statutorily protected expression. Number two, that you suffered an adverse employment action. And number three, that the retaliatory motive was the cause of that adverse action. In other words, that you were fired. You were fired because you engaged in protected speech. Hilton only challenged that first portion. They said, no, this is meant to cover whistleblowers. And the court said, no, like, she engaged in a form of protected activity, which was telling her supervisor, hey, look, you need to accommodate me and you need to accommodate my religious beliefs. And that's the reason she was fired. And The jury found in favor of her on the retaliation claim. And here's what the jury awarded. The jury awarded $36,000 in back pay. They awarded $500,000 for emotional pain and mental anguish. And again, you know, if we have more conservative listeners before, you know, you sort of go, you know, precious little snowflake. Think about the environment in which your supervisor tracks down the person you've gotten to fill in for you and sends that person home and berates you in front of them, right? And there's additional evidence there, right? Like, at the end of the day, the jury made that determination based on their conduct, and I don't think that, you know, some folks believe there's no such thing as intentional infliction of emotional distress. Some folks believe that there's no such thing as mental pain and anguish. But this is not, that's not an outrageous result. And the jury awarded $21 million in punitive damages because it's Hilton, right? Because yeah. The lawyer said, look, like this is a multi-billion dollar corporation and you need to send them a message that it's not okay to hire people who fire people for engaging in perfectly protected legal activities. And the jury said, okay. And they went with $21 million. They initially went with 25. They scratched it down out and went down to 21. But here's the thing. Notwithstanding the fact that the attorney, if that were the case, I would still be mad about how this is being portrayed, right? Because because of all the reasons. In retaliation cases, as part of amendments to the Civil Rights Act of 1964, retaliatory discharge cases have a $300,000 punitive damage cap. The defendants have already filed a motion for an extension of time to file post-judgment motions. Plaintiff's counsel has not opposed that, right? It's going to be tough, right? Like if I were the plaintiff's lawyer, it's going to be really, really tough when the jury says you're getting $21.5 million for me to take you aside and say, you're not. You're getting no more than $536,000. But that's the conversation that was had. The plaintiff's lawyers did not oppose that. They know there is no, it's black and white, right? It is on the level of the president must be 35. It says you cannot award more than $300,000 in punitive damages in a retaliation case. So every source that says she's awarded $21.5 million. It's just wrong. She's not getting $21.5 million. She's going to get no more than $836,000.
Oh, now it's 800. I thought you said
$500 for pain and anguish, $300 max for punitives, and $36,000 in back pay.
Gotcha.
No more than that, and not because she skipped work to go to church, not because she refused to work on Sunday, because her employer retaliated and fired her for having religious beliefs. And
this is really frustrating. I mean, I'm an atheist and I'm 100% on the plaintiff's side and agree with this decision. Yeah. It doesn't, I mean, picture if it doesn't even, as you said, it sounds like the religion barely, if I probably didn't even factor in. I mean, if this were, answer me this. If this were, hey, I've got my kid has a thing on this day. I can't work on this day. I got to do what I mean. I'll take care of a kid, parent, age, elderly. So something would the case have turned out any different?
Yeah. So long. You're exactly right. So long as you engaged in statutorily protected expression. Right. This is no different than. Right. I took off for a medical reason. I took off to go vote. Right.
What jerk do you have to be to say, no, you're going to work on Sunday. Sorry, don't care. And then even that to say it's not even a question of needing a body there on Sunday when the plaintiff swaps shifts to then fire that person for that.
Yeah.
I mean, and I'm really glad you brought this up because this is a case of we can't as if you're in the atheist community or if you're friendly atheist or whoever, we can't be so targeted on the religious component and saying, oh, well, people shouldn't go to church, so this is stupid, that blah, 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 that we ignore the fact that this is just an employer abusing their employee And by the way, multi-billion-dollar corporation abusing their employee, and therefore we should be okay with it because they're a Christian. That should just not be how we look at things.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I'm glad you and I are on the same page on that. I also think there is a pretty disgusting classist element to this, right? Like the CBS headline is, you know, dishwasher, and, you know, and the idea is, oh, well, you know, how could you possibly, you know, rack up $21.5 million, you know, when you're doing this menial job, is, I think that the clear subtext to that. And again, right, as you point out, that's actually part of the basis for the retaliation claim, right? Like if, you know, go the reverse, right? Like, number one, I think we should have the same level of outrage if she had been, you know, the CFO and treated the same way, right? Like,
right.
You know, white collar versus blue collar job shouldn't matter. But if she'd been the CFO, right, like, look, you know, it would be bad if I were to call out, you know, like next Thursday for me to be like, Thomas, I've scheduled someone else to take my shift on opening argument, right? Like, but the arguments about fungibility are pro plaintiff arguments here, right? If anybody can do the shit, can do the job, then, you know, why are you, then it doesn't it show animus when you say, no, it must be you who shows up for your shift.
Absolutely. It does.
And that's why, and that absolutely is why the jury had no problems. Remember, awarding punitive damages, requires a finding of willful malice, right? Like it's hard to show punitive damages, and, you know, to second guess what the jury saw, and, you know, and kind of, you know, tut about
and,
this.
And is, we really need is to stop looking at these things in terms of, oh, does this one person really deserve all that windfall or something like that? And start realizing that these companies, same with the McDonald's case, you need to, if you're trying to punish the company, you need to do something that's going to actually punish the company. They have all the power. They have billions and billions of dollars. And the idea that since it's just but a, you know, a quote unquote lowly dishwasher, therefore they can get rid of them. And because they only ever would have to pay out, you know, a little bit of salary, it would never be a cost to them. That's not going to be sustainable. That'll make it so easy for them to abuse people in the future. So I think we need to stop thinking in terms of like, oh, this person doesn't deserve all that money. It's like, no, that's not the important part.
I could not agree more.
Well, I'm really glad you broke that down, because that's frustrating. We got to make sure we're getting things right, you know. And I wonder, you know, maybe some sources will skate by on the technicality of like, yes, they were awarded $21 million by the jury. You know, like technically, is that true? Versus it'll be capped later on.
Oh yeah, look, I would not say that that. Either of these sources have, you know, committed actionable libel. I'm saying that I think it is irresponsible and misleading.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
If you don't know, and both of these articles, I mean, this is the CBS. It's particularly galling because it's a 10 paragraph article, and in paragraph 9 it says, oh, by the way, you know, defense counsel says that there's going to be a $300,000 cap on punitive damages. Great. I mean, way to stick that in paragraph 9 of your article under, you know, your 97-point font heading and opening paragraph, right? You know, and some folks have said, well, you know, you don't always choose, you know, sometimes the editors will choose the heading. I'm going to link the articles in the show notes, and I certainly know the way in which they were forwarded to me. Right. I mean, people forwarded it to me and said, isn't this outrageous? You know, are you going to talk about it on the show? And I wrote back and said, yes, it is, but not for the reasons you think. I think the intent is pretty clear there. And that's why.
Well done. Good breakdown. And I will shoot Friendly Atheist an email. Try to be as constructive in everything as possible. But if people want to chirp on Twitter when this comes out or something, if you want to attack nicely, constructively, because I, you know,
let's
I,
be
I
friendly.
Like friendly exactly. I like friendly atheists. That's Hemant Mehta, of course. But yeah, no, it's important to get stuff right. So I think that's good.
Yeah, and, okay. And Hemant didn't write this one. It was a guy named Jim G.
Okay.
I don't know him. I clicked. It looks like it's a pseudonym. He doesn't have any okay. qualifications under it. But I did check it out.
Okay. All right. Well, great stuff. And it's time to move to our co-favorite segment of the week. Gosh, really is. It's top two. It's top two. I don't know that I can decide. They're both great. And that is to thank our new patrons at patreon.com/law. And this week we have to thank Robin Antony, the Silenced Masses. I don't know. Sorry what that is. Mary Trump, White House guest versus 43.5 gross hamburgers. That's a really good one. Black Raven, Sam Nope, like returning patron there. Arise, Rodimus Prime.
Oh,
that's either a Transformers reference or it's another anagram.
No, that's one of the greatest Transformers references of all time. So.
Oh, okay. Alito, Cheeto, Benito, Banana, Fana, Fofito, Fi-Fi, Mofito, Alito. I like it.
Oh.
Nick Riley and Kino Brandt. Thank you so much.
Hey, anytime patrons want us to play the name game, I'm down for that. Don't do that if your name is Chucky. But anyway, thanks to Yarrow Kassir, to Matthew Williams, Jennifer Kratch, to ... which I hope is a Beethoven ... to
or
Richard.
It's Morse or something.
Yeah,
is that,
well,
could be.
Could be. To Richard Marsh, to Richard Bjorndridge. Richard Bjorndridge, I'm going to go with. Feel free to correct us via email. Jason Martin, SI Skeptic, and Katrina, corollary to Clark's Third Law. I like that. Thank you all so much for supporting the show. We really appreciate it. It truly does make this one of our favorite aspects of doing the show, and we couldn't do it without you.
All right, and now it's time for the answer to last week's TTTDBE. I think I might add an extra T there. Thomas Trangley takes the something like
the
so
extra
here we go.
T is for BYOB. Yeah.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right. So this was a UCC question. This was about a bottling company that sent a purchase order to a wholesaler, said, send us 100,000 empty bottles. Then 2 days after receiving the purchase order, the wholesaler ships the bottles and the bottling company accepts delivery of the bottles. A week after that, the bottling company sends out this acknowledgement form, which has some terms and conditions on it, including a provision that says, hey, we're not liable for consequential damages. The bottling company continues to use the bottles after it for 2 months. And then
Hold on. This is important if I got this wrong. The way you said it, it sounded like the disclaimer was saying, oh, apropos of nothing, if there's any consequential damages, we're not responsible. Versus I interpreted it as, because it says, which included a provision disclaiming, a disclaimer. That sounds like they're saying there are damages here.
No, I
must have gotten it wrong.
let's be specific here.
Continue
by by disclaiming consequential damages, that means the contract says we are not liable for consequential damages to you.
So it's my
part
problem.
Of
okay,
right? So it's part of the contract, here. Right? And then the bottling company continues to use the bottles for another 2 months, and then discovers a defect, and then sues for $40,000 after the recall to fix the defect, which are and the question helpfully defines this for you. They didn't have to, but the question says, by the way, those are consequential damages. So then the question becomes, was the contract valid when the wholesaler ships and the bottling company receives the bottles, which is 2 days before, which is 2 days after placing the order and a week before getting the contract that has the provision that says we're not liable for it? Or is the fact that the bottling company continued to use the bottles after receiving that notice and contract, did that incorporate those terms? So that's the way to analyze that question.
I think is more or less how I did it, but it sounds like I was a little, it sounds like I had a crucial misunderstanding of a certain phrase. So we'll see if it factored in.
We will. So you narrowed it down to B and C. So you eliminated the A answer. No, because buyers generally are not entitled to recover consequential damages. That's a good elimination because buyers generally are entitled to recover consequential damages. The reason that you would have a contract that disclaims those is to get around the basic rule.
That right? makes sense, right? Yep. Yeah.
So good elimination on A. Then you were choosing between B and C. C is yes, because the disclaimer of consequential damages is unconscionable. That's good that you didn't settle in on C because that answer is also incorrect. You can disclaim consequential damages if voluntarily agreed to in a contract between sophisticated parties where they both agree to the terms, right? There's no coercion, right? There's nothing that suggests that the party didn't mean to accept those terms. So the question really comes down to B or D. You went with B, no, because the bottling company's acceptance also constituted an acceptance of the terms included in the wholesaler's acknowledgement. That's not true.
Gotcha.
Yeah, it's actually D, yes, because the wholesaler's acknowledgement did not alter the terms of the existing contract between the parties. So this is UCC 2-206.
So I think it did matter that I didn't understand what when I see the term. This is really curious to me. Disclaiming consequential damages. I still don't understand how those words mean. Like we're saying we're not liable for consequential. That's what disclaiming means in a legal sense.
Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah. Okay. So what happens here is under the UCC and under contract law generally, the terms for the sale of goods are established upon acceptance of an offer. So 2206 says an offer to buy goods for prompt shipment is accepted when the seller ships or promises to ship the goods. And then the acceptance of that offer, right? The shipment occurs before the bottling company gets that acknowledgement.
Yeah, no, this
is
unfortunate because I think if I had a clear understanding of what was happening, I think I actually might have gotten it right because I know that you can't just slip in a thing modifying a contract. Oh, by the way, quick modification here. It's unfortunate. So, but
well,
hey,
you would have had a good. I mean, you would have had an interesting, attractive distractor if.
Yeah,
you know, on
I'm
the
not
basis
saying I
of,
definitely would have gotten it right, but had I known that that's what that meant, like I didn't. I thought they were sending an alert of like, oh, there might be something wrong with these. Like when because disclaimer alert. You know, like I didn't. I guess it's not in the sense of disclaiming something. It's not in the sense of disclaimer. It's in the sense of. You can't claim this? Is that what that means?
Yeah.
Okay. Right. So that's the misunderstanding I had. Right. So
it's saying who knows? We're not responsible for any consequential damages that occur as a result of us shipping you these goods.
I guess I'll have to hope I remember that vocabulary lesson next time. That sucks. Yeah, I think I might have been able to puzzle that out had I known, but I just got the wrong idea of what that meant.
Yeah.
And part of the reason I took it that way is because it doesn't make any sense to send a contract modification like that. You know what I mean? Like from context, I'm thinking, okay, well, surely they're not sending this modifies our contract. If they're sending a little form, you know what I mean? Like it's almost the reason the question is the way it is part of the reason why I interpreted it the way I did. But
so I'm really good. You raised that because, this is actually an issue I see. It's part of why I try and get small businesses to call me and engage me and to pay my exorbitant rates. it happens with far more regularity than you would expect in the business world, where the parties negotiate a deal and then start shipping and then kind of send the paperwork later. And so, you know, this shows the perils, right, if that relationship breaks down, of having done that. And so, you know, look, there are ways. We're kind of late, so I'm not going to get through, you know, exactly. You could work a novation. You could modify this contract. But I see all the time where, you know, people think like, oh, well, you know, like we're just gonna go ahead and, you know, practice. We'll do that. And you know, it can come around to, you know, sort of bite you in the behind. This, you might think of this as, obviously it's a UCC, that's a 20th century US, but analogous to the 13th century Saxony rules, right? That there's a little bit of defeating maybe the party's expectations here, right? Because if you're the manufacturer, you might come back in a situation like this and go, come on, like we agreed, everybody knew, it was a rush, I got the bottles out the door, and then I sent the paper a couple of days later, and then he kept using them for 2 months. Come on.
Yeah.
And that's a fair point, but under UCC rules, the manufacturer would be stuck here. Wow. So
tough question.
Yeah. So tough question and good. Like I'm glad we got a chance. I'm sorry that you misread the term.
I'm not a lawyer, and so sometimes I read words and I interpret them the wrong non-law way, and that's
the right way, but the non-lawyer way.
Yeah, it's just the non-law. That's why we pay lawyers to do work, because they know their stuff and I don't. So that's fine. I got it wrong, but let's see. Who knows who will come out of the time machine? Maybe it'll be like, if there's a fly in there with a time machine, then it's going to be like a half fly, half Andrew kind of thing. We'll see. But somebody hop in the time machine and tell us who this week's winner of TTTBE is. And I'm very curious to see if they got it right, or if, you know, who the winner is.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
Well, Thomas, this week's winner is John Mellon on Twitter, who says, just getting around to sending over my terms and conditions for when you read my TTTBE answer on the air the other week. You'll note that there's a mandatory $100 tweet appearance fee, but assuming that's not legal, I'll just answer D for this week's TTTBE free of charge. Beautifully well illustrated. Got the answer right. Congratulations, John, on being this week's winner. And everyone should give him a follow on Twitter. That is at JON_MELLON. And congratulations on being this week's winner.
All right. Well, thanks so much for listening. Heartbreaker of a question, but dust myself off and get back. Pull myself up by my own suspenders. And get back at it next week. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting. Really valuable. Makes the show happen. Please consider going to patreon.com/law and getting those goodies. Lot Awful movies. All that good stuff. Patron only question threads. And we'll see you very soon. Today, in fact, for that live Q&A.
Can't wait.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.